The following is For Your Ears Only. Now in our 31st year, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Syria turning point. Could rebel success break a Security Council stalemate or make it irrelevant?
The nastiest campaign. Escalating personal attacks mark the presidential campaign, but with what collateral damage?
In praise of the creative class. Not traditional businessmen and investors, but a growing breed tied to technology that one expert claims could define a new prosperity.
I'll be hard to handle. Cabaret star Karen Oberlin celebrates songs by and about strong-willed women.
Silent Giant, a psychologist salute to his once-famous uncle, an 8-foot, 6-inch survivor of crippling shyness, circus sideshows, and pre-talkies Hollywood.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For Your Ears Only, for the week of July 22nd, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog.
Unfortunately, we've even seen some elements of blackmail. I consider it a totally counterproductive and dangerous approach, because it is unacceptable to use the observers as a bargaining chip.
The United Kingdom is appalled by the decision of Russia and China to veto this draft resolution aimed at bringing an end to the bloodshed in Syria and to create the conditions for meaningful political progress.
In the end, the UN Security Council backed away from what Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov called blackmail, the threat to remove 300 unarmed observers from Syria if Russia again vetoed stronger economic sanctions and even possible military action against the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. The observer mission, already sidelined for a month, last week was reauthorized for at least another 30 days, if only to arrange a more orderly withdrawal. But Russia and China vetoed the sanctions anyway, as violence escalated in the heart of Damascus following the rebel bombing of a security center there that killed 4 top military and intelligence officials.
Some saw the bombing as another long step down the road to civil war, with Assad likely launching even more bloody counterattacks on rebel hubs and innocent civilians nearby. Others saw a possible turning point in the conflict that has already claimed an estimated 17,000 lives, producing more defections from the army's Sunni Muslim rank and file, and raising fear among Assad's Alawite elite, who now see themselves as vulnerable and perhaps safer switching sides. To consider what happened on the front lines last week and what did not at the UN, For Your Ears Only, we're joined by Khalid Saleh from the Executive Committee of the Syrian National Council. Welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
You were part of a Syrian National Council delegation that urged action at the UN last week. Some reports called it an ultimatum. What was your argument?
I wouldn't go as far as ultimatum. Really, we came in, we visited with the different members of the Permanent Council, and we had a simple message that we carried out to them. We are looking for ways to protect the civilian population in Syria. At this point in time, we have 19,865 confirmed deaths in Syria. We have 65,000 that are detained, about 100,000 that are disappeared completely, and we have no accounts for them. And our message was, what can the UN do to stop the bloodshed in Syria? I had an interesting discussion with Ambassador Rice, where she was asking us about our opinion in terms of the resolution that ended up being vetoed by the Russians and the Chinese. And she simply asked me, what do you think about the resolution? And I asked her, I said, do you think this resolution, if passed, would it stop the bloodshed in Syria? And she nodded her head and she said, sorry to tell you, no, it would not. So the sad reality is that we were chasing after a weak resolution, a resolution that does not stop the bloodshed, and yet the Russians and the Chinese chose to intervene on behalf of Assad and try and protect the regime again. And one thing I wanted to make clear about the regime that which they vetoed, that regime had no mention of military intervention in Syria. As a matter of fact, it excluded military intervention in Syria. All it talked about is if Assad does not pull his heavy arms outside of the cities, then what the United Nations can do is 10 days later, they can come back and consider sanctions. It's not even automatic sanctions. We're talking about just the possibility of considering economic sanctions, and yet Russia and China can continue to protecting the regime and say, you know what, we're not going to even go for that.
Let's turn to the action on the ground. Which rebel group do you understand was responsible for that bombing, and what does its effectiveness mean for the rivalry among the various more and less Islamist opposition forces and the prospect for some greater unity? Does that bombing give one group a particular advantage and leadership role now?
Well, the way I think the image that's really that the media conveys about the different units of the FSA is not necessarily very accurate. At this point,
that's the Free Syrian Army, FSA.
That's the Free Syrian Army. The units under the Free Syrian Army accounts for about 67,000 soldiers at this point. Of those 67,000 soldiers, there's about 45,000 that are in five different units in five different provinces of Syria. In the area of Deir ez-Zor, the military council over there has about 7,000 soldiers. In Homs, the unit of Al-Faruq has about 8,000 soldiers. So these are the ones that are coordinating this effort. In terms of the unit that carried out the operation, it's Liwa al-Islam. It's one of three large units in the Damascus and the suburbs of Damascus. Those units coordinate tremendously amongst each other. I think it showed Assad that the FSA, that the Free Syrian Army, is able to get to the heart and the command and control centers. And I think that really caused lots of confusion and caused lots of worry, not only amongst the Assad forces, but also for the Russians who have been staunch supporters of the Assad regime.
Do you think that it says more likely a military victory over Assad's forces or a demoralization of those forces to the point that Assad has to leave?
I think it's very demoralizing. They definitely lost a little bit of control. What's interesting to me is the way that the state TV decided to come out and make the announcement of an operation like this and its success. They lost control. They didn't know what to do. So they come out and they announce the death of those four military generals that they have. And because it was not very well planned on their part, many of the units in the Assad regime, their Shabiha, their militiamen, end up throwing their arms and just running away, thinking that the regime is gonna lose control. So I think it was a major blow, very demoralizing. I still think we have a long battle ahead of us, but this really took out many of the first class leadership that the Assad relied on. Another interesting point is yesterday we had the funeral of three of those generals in Tartus, and what's interesting is that neither Assad nor his brother Maher attended that funeral. That's unheard of, because here the funeral is taking place in the heart of the regime-controlled area. We at least expected to see Maher, the brother of Bashar Assad, to attend the funeral. The state TV was making lots of claims that he was there, he's going to show up, and on Sunday he did not show up. So that leaves many question marks about even the fate of Maher and whether he survived that attack or not.
What can you say about the threat of chemical weapons that Assad has been mobilizing and reports that some opposition forces may try to take control of them or that Israel may attack them to protect itself?
Well, we've known about these movements, about the chemical weapons movements for some time now. This is something that we've discussed with the Russians. This is something that we've discussed with the U.S. government, where we said, you know, the Russians continue to protect the Assad regime. And this is a regime that could be out of control, that's willing to destroy the whole country. At what point, what guarantees can the Russians give us? And we said, point blank asked, Are chemical weapons, are they a red line? And we were told, yes, they are a red line. Russians have conveyed, and they have the influence, they have enough intelligence on the ground to guarantee that chemical weapons will not be used.
Khalid Saleh is a Syrian-American e-commerce entrepreneur on the board of United for a Free Syria and an executive committee member of the Syrian National Council.
Quote from the news, this was tit for tat. That was an anonymous American official on the likely Iranian connection to a bus bombing in Bulgaria that killed five Israeli tourists, which he saw as revenge for the recent assassination of several Iranian atomic scientists to slow Tehran's nuclear development.
Next, is this the nastiest presidential campaign ever? For your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. I told my girlfriend to just play dead. That was 25-year-old Chandler Brannan on the massacre and a midnight premiere of The Dark Knight Rises in Aurora, Colorado, that left at least 12 dead and 59 wounded, the largest mass shooting in U.S. history, by a black-clad 24-year-old neuroscience graduate student with a legally purchased arsenal including two pistols, shotgun, assault rifle, and thousands of rounds of ammo. President Obama and GOP challenger Mitt Romney both suspended campaigning but said nothing about tougher gun control laws. And few political analysts expected a major legislative response. Now this.
The costs of not releasing the returns are clear. Therefore, he must have calculated that there are higher costs in releasing.
And he's going to, there's obviously something there, because if there was nothing there, he would say, have at it.
There are so many things that will be open again for more attack. And you just want to give more material for more attack. And that's really, that's just the answer. And we've given all people need to know.
A chorus of calls for Mitt Romney to release more tax returns from Republicans like columnist George Will and former Bush campaign advisor Matthew Dowd was quickly captured in a new Democratic TV ad last week. Ann Romney herself seemed to concede their point in an interview with Robin Roberts of ABC News, admitting that more returns will mean more targets for political mudslinging, however relevant they may or may not be to the serious issues underlining campaign 2012.
To consider both the mudslinging and the serious issues for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Sean West of Eurasia Group, international risk analyst and head of its new U.S. practice. Welcome back to our program.
Hi, thanks very much for having me.
First, tell us why Eurasia Group, despite the regional specialization implied by its name, has launched a new U.S. domestic practice and what your primary focus will be.
Well, we're very excited about this new formal practice to cover U.S. political risk. Eurasia Group's always been globally focused, but is mainly known for its emerging markets coverage. Over the last few years, that's changed. Since the financial crisis, the political risks in developed economies in the U.S., in Europe, et cetera, have really dominated the market's attention, and weakness in economic recovery has been important for firms to try and understand as they position themselves for the future. So what we set out to do was try and predict these events from a sort of distance, to take a step back and focus on the issues that matter most to firms and investors and try and get in front of them with forecasts that are able to discount noise and isolate effects and impacts. So what's important from our perspective is that firms and investors have a place they can go to get advice about what's going to happen on the issues that matter, on the election, on fiscal policy, on trade policy, on housing finance reform, on financial industry reform, et cetera.
What do you make of Romney's resistance to releasing multiple years of tax returns, as so many GOP leaders have advised?
Well, I think it's natural, and it's probably the right move until it's untenable. There's really no upside for Romney in releasing these tax returns. However, the question that he must be asking himself is when the downside is so great in terms of scrutiny and questions about what he's hiding that he has no choice but to go forward. I've seen some comparisons to Obama, the sort of Obama birth certificate revelation argument. But of course, there was always an upside for the president. Once you reveal the birth certificate, then it's clear where you were born, provided that the facts were there. For Romney and the tax returns, unless he reveals that he pays way more taxes than everybody ever thought he did, which certainly from this time period is probably not the case, there's not a whole lot of upside for him. Questions about, you know, did he make money off the collapse of the financial crisis, or did he lose lots of money that therefore reduced his tax burden? Did he bring a lot of money back offshore? Did he move back from offshore to take advantage of certain amnesties, or did he move money offshore to take advantage of tax breaks? I mean, there's really not a whole lot of upside in giving the Obama campaign something that they can pour through, as Romney's pointed out, to find all the negative stories.
How do you think Obama and the Democrats have done raising doubts about the relevance of Romney's larger business experience to running a country whose poorest citizens can't be sold off or shut down to benefit the bottom line?
Well, I think what they've done is at least chipped away at Romney's narrative that he is the one to create jobs and get the economy back on track. I mean, Romney really is a one-issue candidate. His views on everything beside the economy don't really matter. So if Romney can get traction with independent voters with a belief that he knows about economic management and business management and that President Barack Obama has been ineffective, then Romney wins. So the Obama campaign, I think, has successfully raised questions and played into populist tendencies amongst a lot of voters, whether it's about the way the wealthy live, whether it's about firms that outsource, whether it's about how financial firms earn their profits, et cetera. Obama's raised a lot of questions about that. The interesting thing is it's only July. You usually see these sorts of things come to the fore after the national conventions, where outside groups start to do the negative campaigning. The fact that the Obama campaign is starting so early with this indicates, one, that it's a line they intend to carry throughout the entire election, two, that it's a central narrative, and three, that they think that this is going to effectively return the president to the White House. And from our perspective so far, they're doing a decent job at it.
Talk about the fallout of all of these business-related issues. On the issue of stiffening regulations on the whole U.S. financial sector, especially following the multi-billion-dollar botch by J.P. Morgan Chase, manipulation of an international lending rate by Britain's Barclays Bank, and maybe a dozen others already under investigation in the U.S. and worldwide, Republicans in Congress are in a bit of a box.
Absolutely. This is an interesting example of the Republican Party taking a hard line on an issue which had clear benefits for them to do, and then realizing that taking a sort of black and white position it comes with risks. I'll explain that. I think when the Dodd-Frank legislation was brought forward, Republicans said basically, we're not going to kill this, but we're going to allow the minimum number of votes to support it, and then we're going to say that it's job killing and that it stifles growth, etc. Well, that line is that's a risky narrative. It works because the financial industry likes the fact that the Republican Party put that forward and will send money to them, and it works until there's a scandal. Once there's a scandal on the back of the large financial crisis that we're still trying to get ourselves out of, it's no longer tenable for Republicans to appear openly friendly to the financial firms. Now they have to weave sort of they have to walk a very tight rope between not alienating the financial firms that have come back into their fold and directed lots of money towards them, but also voters who every time they look up, they see another scandal coming out of Wall Street. So for Republicans are in a bit of a box, and I think the best answer for them is just to stay quiet on these financial issues. For Democrats, it's going to be to raise these issues and explain why Republicans have been trying to water down the legislation. The bottom line is Republicans have done a good job, and the financial firm has done a good job up until this point of weakening implementation of Dodd-Frank and sort of raising questions about its effectiveness. I actually think the tide is turning on that front with all these scandals.
Sean West is the head of a new U.S. practice at Eurasia Group, international risk analysts and consultants.
Quote from the news, "No logic, no basis, no merit." That was Senator John McCain on the flimsy allegations by Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann and four GOP House colleagues of al-Qaeda infiltration of the administration, most notably by Huma Abedin, Deputy Chief of Staff for Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. She's also the wife of former New York Congressman Anthony Weiner, an outspoken defender of Israel before an email sex scandal forced his resignation.
Next, can a new creative class save the U.S. economy? For your ears only.
We have more for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania, done. That was Mike Terzai, Republican Majority Leader of Pennsylvania's House of Representatives, undermining the party line that there was no partisan motive behind a new law requiring all voters to have a state-approved photo ID, similar to many others now being challenged by civil liberties and minority groups around the country. Now this.
Somebody helped to create this unbelievable American system that we had that allowed you to thrive. Somebody invested in roads and bridges. If you got a business, that you didn't build that. Somebody else made that happen.
This is not the result of government. This is the result of people who take risk, who have dreams, who build for themselves and for their families.
The White House contenders continue to jab at each other over job creation. Barack Obama stressed the physical and economic infrastructure that makes such creation possible. Had he said you don't build a business all by yourself, the president might have been less vulnerable to attacks by Mitt Romney and other Republicans, who implied he had revealed an almost un-American ignorance of the capitalist system.
But what kind of infrastructure and what kind of jobs will really revive our economy in the globalized environment of our information age? 10 years ago, a book by Professor Richard Florida provided one answer, titled The Rise of the Creative Class. It also foresaw some of the critical problems that have arisen since. Now comes The Rise of the Creative Class Revisited, a 10th anniversary edition, with new research on the current role and future prospects of these highly educated, tech-savvy generators of new products, processes, and profitable pleasures. And for your ears only, we're pleased to have Richard Florida on the line now. Welcome to our program.
It's great to be with you.
Give us a more comprehensive definition of the creative class.
Well, the creative class makes up 40 million American workers. And you know, it's not just artists and designers people who live in do creative work. It's scientists, it's techies, it's entrepreneurs, it's innovators, it's knowledge-based workers in business and management, healthcare, and the law. They account for about a third of our workforce, produce $2 trillion in salaries and wages, have never seen an unemployment rate, even in the depth of the crisis, go above 5%. And in some cities in metro areas, they make up more than 45, nearly half of the workforce. So they're really the growth force and economic force powering our economy.
While presidential campaign rhetoric is focused on the manufacturing jobs of yesterday, you say that the nation's economic future could depend more on this new creative class. But the definition and requirements for that class seem to exclude so many working people, blue-collar working people. How can it become the centerpiece of a new political, cultural, economic order, locally and nationally?
Well, it has to be. Our economy has become an innovative and knowledge and creative-driven economy. As I said, it's 50% of all wages and salaries, three-quarters of domestic purchasing power. The creative class is what invents our iPods and apps and new television series and new music and entertainment options that power the U.S. and the world economy. But at the same time, it's important to recognize that my very theory comes from understanding the best manufacturing companies. And in those best high-performance manufacturing companies, we rose wages, we increased productivity by not treating the worker like an arm or a back or a source of physical labor, but tapping into the workers' minds, engaging them in continuous improvement, seeing work groups as the source of innovation. We have to do that for all of our workers, including the nearly 60 million, in fact, more than 60 million, who toil in low-wage service jobs that almost every political candidate has forgotten about and pundit. Those people make half of what a blue-collar worker makes and a third of what a creative class worker makes. We have to engage them in innovation. We have to tap their creativity. We have to drive up the wages of people who, you know, prepare our food, take care of our children, take care of our aging parents, take care of our homes. Those jobs can't be offshored, and we have to make them better jobs if we want to create a middle class and grow our economy.
Well, what are some of the areas where the contributions of your creative class can be best observed?
From Silicon Valley to Seattle, from San Francisco to Boston, in New York City, in Austin, Texas, in Boulder, Colorado, even in the heart of the Rust Belt, in Ann Arbor, in Madison, and now rebuilding Detroit. It's that creative class that is developing the new cutting-edge projects, and not just in technology. You know, right now in America, something that's very heartening is that young creatives are going back and reinventing our manufacturing industries. They're adding design to everything from bicycle making to furniture making, and they're going back and reinventing agriculture, developing cleaner and greener, more organic, locavore ways of doing agriculture. So in a sense, this creative engine is the source of growth and prosperity. We have to get away from thinking that housing and cars and financial shenanigans will build our future. Hopefully the crisis did that, and get back in touch with our core economic asset, which is the creativity of all of our people. You know, there is an interesting argument. In fact, Tom Friedman of the New York Times made this once, that places that are endowed with natural resources, they have a curse, he called it, and he pointed at the Middle East. I think
One of the things that's really amazing about the United States, and I also live in Toronto part of the year, teach at the University of Toronto, also true of Canada, is the natural resource centers of the United States and Canada. Let's take two in particular, Houston, Texas, and Calgary, Alberta. They have combined this ability to extract stuff out of the ground with cutting-edge creativity. You know, Houston has one of the highest concentrations of software workers in the world, and Alberta and Calgary, Canada, has the highest incomes in North America.
To what degree is the creative class concerned about the arguments over government regulations as a mechanism for equality, fairness, and environmental preservation?
When it comes to the creative class, they're a very interesting political beast. And some are in, many are independent, some skew Republican, some skew Democrat, but they share a couple of things in common. One, they tend to be fiscally conservative. They don't want government squandering their money. Two, they tend to be socially progressive or liberal. They want open rights to all, to live the way they want and have the families they want. And three, they're very concerned with big public goods questions, like making sure we have a clean environment, and making sure we have good schools and opportunity for all. So that's the kind of profile. What's sad is, although actually, what's good is our mayors are moving towards that space, our big city mayors from Mike Bloomberg to Ron Emanuel and others, but our national politics seems so terribly divided and dysfunctional that the creative class doesn't really see a candidate that's their guy.
Richard Florida is director of the Martin Prosperity Institute at the University of Toronto and author of The Rise of the Creative Class Revisited, 10th Anniversary Edition from Basic Books this month.
Quote from the news, it's big. That was BCG Partners analyst Colin Gillis on the pay package that lured six-month pregnant Google executive Marissa Mayer to sign on as the new CEO of Yahoo. It could total $129 million over 5 years if she can revive the early online giant.
Next of Daring Dames, we sing for your ears only.
We have more for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. Do you think that it is accidental that the really vicious, fire-breathing, four-eyed whatever it is villain in this movie is named Bane? That was conservative radio showman Rush Limbaugh, implying that Hollywood had named the villain of The Dark Knight Rises to embarrass Republican presidential hopeful Mitt Romney, founder of the controversial private equity firm Bain Capital, B-A-I-N. In fact, the villain Bane, B-A-N-E, was introduced to Batman comic books in 1993. Now this.
Some women are colder than steel. From such a fate, heaven preserve us. Some women repress how they feel. And that's why some women are nervous. Life is love, you know that. Love is life, and so that should make you forgive, for a lady must live.
Some women in song may be soft and as pink as a nursery, as Irving Berlin wrote for the 1946 show Annie Get Your Gun, but remember that show star lived by a more confrontational credo, anything you can do, I can do better. In the same vein, A Lady Must Live was an anthem of sexual equality by Richard Rodgers and Lorenz Hart for the 1931 musical America's Sweetheart. And it's one of the numbers in a new show of songs by and about willful women that cabaret performer Karen Oberlin brings this week to Feinstein's Supper Club in Manhattan's Loews Regency Hotel.
The new show takes its title, I'll Be Hard to Handle, from a song by Jerome Kern and Bernard Dougal for the 1933 show Roberta. And there are other tunes by more contemporary writers, including Joni Mitchell and Loretta Lynn. To talk about all the songs and the women involved for your ears only, we're pleased to have Karen Oberlin on the line again. Welcome back to our show.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
So what led you to the theme for this show?
Well, there was a seed for this show in a show that I produced and wrote about 15 years ago with the same title, but that was more about daring of all kinds and independent thinking, not necessarily of the feminine kind as it is with this show.
What's your definition of a woman who's hard to handle, a really willful woman or daring dame?
That's a good question. I believe that anybody who is sort of swimming upstream going against what society is telling you to do is showing signs of willfulness and daring. When you believe in something that might be a go against what the culture is telling you, that's something to sing about, I think.
Well, were there any daring dames who shaped your own sense of women and yourself?
There sure were. My mother, who I'm lucky to say, happy to say, is still around, and she's a philosophy professor. And she had a very overbearing father, and she was a feminist and identified with her mother, who was a scientist, and her mother was a cartographer, and my father's mother was a vaudevillian. So I have lots of women in my family, great feminine DNA for showing a lot of courage and to have careers in a time when women were more often than not expected to give them up once they got married.
One of the songwriters in your show is Dorothy Fields, who may have been the first woman songwriter considered to be one of the boys, like Berlin, Kern, Rodgers,
yeah.
Hart, Hammerstein. Is there a real difference in the way she writes about women, their relationships and feelings?
Well, my feeling is that, in a way, she deliberately didn't do that, because she was determined to prove herself as one of the boys, and she certainly did. She could write love songs, comedic songs, ballads, up-tempo songs, very clever material, just as well as the boys could. And I think that's what, in a way, set her apart, ironically, as a female songwriter, although she did have some contemporary women songwriters. Kay Swift was a wonderful songwriter, and then, of course, Carolyn Lee and some others who could do the same thing in the Tin Pan Alley era. But I think what she did in a way that was so daring was to dare to write in a meritocracy of songwriting and to write just as well as the boys could.
What about Joni Mitchell and her special view?
Joni Mitchell could write beautifully from the feminine perspective. I've chosen one of her songs, Cactus Tree, that's always been one of my favorite songs. And it's a sympathetic view, I think, of just feminine freedom, of saying that I can love many people, but what I need to do, what this person, the character, needs to do is to be free and not be tied down.
Talk
in a
about...
beautiful way. It's a beautiful song, and just I'm a huge Joni Mitchell fan. So
talk about some of the blues you sing that are associated with Bessie Smith, Sophie Tucker, Ethel Waters, who was my neighbor in Brooklyn so many years ago.
What a neighborhood with Ethel Waters. That's fantastic. Well, these women were so inspiring. To make a study of their material, which I've done, it's literally awesome to think that within the era when they were writing in the early to mid 20th century, if you listen to the other music that was out there at the same time and how conservative it was, to think that these women were writing lyrics about feminine freedom and sexual freedom and writing songs about women loving women or all the troubles and trials of the day or abuse, physical abuse. All it was a way for women to communicate with other women and with the culture, to express themselves in a way that just didn't exist anywhere else in the culture in that period. So we have sort of a medley in the show that expresses the high points of many of these songs, and it's just astounding.
Karen Oberlin's new show, I'll Be Hard to Handle, plays July 24th through the 28th at Feinstein's Cabaret at Manhattan's Loews Regency Hotel.
What's the siren song for? What is my chaise longue for? So you must forgive for a lady must live. You must forgive for a lady must live.
Quote from the news, she left a country where people know her worth. She will come back to a country where she means nothing. That was Rafael Pereira, professor of art history in Venezuela, on the recovery of a Matisse painting, the topless odalisque in red pants, stolen from the Contemporary Art Museum of Caracas at least 2 years ago, during which time no one noticed that a bad fake had been hung to replace it.
Next, Silent Giant, Hollywood and circus star Jake Ehrlich, for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. The press likes to paint us as nine scorpions in a bottle. That's just not the case. That was Associate Justice Antonin Scalia to Piers Morgan on CNN, denying personal friction on the Supreme Court and specifically any rift between himself and Chief Justice John Roberts over the decision upholding health care reform. Now this.
Music from the era of silent movies sets the stage for our segment on giant Jacob Reuben Ehrlich. The son of German-Jewish immigrants at the turn of the 20th century and standing an astonishing 8'6" tall, making him one of the world's tallest men, Ehrlich took the anglicized name Jack Earl for roles in some 50 silent films, then as a sideshow freak, touring 14 years with Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus, before winning renown as a painter, poet and sculptor, dancer, musician and vaudeville entertainer.
In a new book titled The Long Shadows, the story of Jake Ehrlich, his nephew Andrew Ehrlich, a Phoenix psychologist, draws on 10 years of research into family lore, newspaper archives, historical documents, and recordings to tell the inspiring story of how his Uncle Jake overcame crippling shyness and prejudice, as well as depression and the physical challenges of his super stature. And for your ears only, we're pleased to have Andrew Ehrlich on the line now. Thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
You describe your book as a true life novel. Why not a straight biography, and what parts are fictionalized?
At first, I tried to write this as a biography, but, David, there was so much that I couldn't know about Jake's motivation and the dialogue that he had with others, as well as the struggles that he went through. So I had to put myself into his voice. I chose to do it as what I call a true-life novel.
Well, we mentioned your research into family history for this book. Did you remember actually meeting your uncle or the first family stories you heard about him?
I have one memory. He died on my third birthday, actually July 18th, 1952. But I had one memory, what we in the psychology business call a screen memory. And Jake was throwing me up in the air. And my grandmother, her name was Dora Ehrlich, she had three sons, and she was so nervous she was screaming out her three sons' names until she finally, you know, got the right one. Mm-hmm. And she said, "Jake, put him down. He's going to hit his head on the ceiling." Well, she had a point.
Talk about Jake's beginnings. How did he get from El Paso, where he was born, to Hollywood, and how was he discovered? Not that he was easy to miss.
By the time Jake was 7 years old, that's when he really started to grow. He was 6 feet tall. By the time he finished the sixth grade at age 12, according to his teacher, he was 7 feet tall. So he became very, very depressed. There was no way to really stop or explain what was going on with him. So Jake started to encounter a lot of taunts and teasing, so he was taking back alleys to avoid the other kids and the rocks they threw at him because of his height. So he got very depressed. My granddad took him to California, supposedly for a fishing trip, because Jake liked to fish. And word spread in the silent film community about this boy giant. And a couple of pioneers from the silent film industry spotted him and offered him a contract in silent movies.
Why did Jake eventually leave Hollywood to join the circus? It sounds like a step down in both comfort and money.
Jake was filming his 49th movie, and silent film actors used to do their own stunts. And he was precariously balanced on what they called a studio funny car. So the car is going about 45 miles an hour, goes over a pothole. Jake loses his balance, and he falls 14 feet to the ground. Once he does, a piece of wood breaks off a scaffolding that's attached to the same contraption, hits him in the back of the head. He wakes up in the hospital with a fractured nose and blurred vision. And first, the doctors say, well, the vision is a problem from the Klieg lights, these powerful lights that they used on the sets in those days. But 3 days later, they had to change their diagnosis when Jake goes completely blind. Finally, they figure out he must, in fact, have a brain tumor that's grown to the point it's pressing on the optic nerve. Well, they start treating him with x-rays, and those x-rays shrink the tumor, and paradoxically, Jake stops growing and his vision comes back. But in order to go back to Hollywood, he realized he'd have to keep doing his own stunts, and that was just too dangerous. So that's the point, when he's recuperating in El Paso, that Ringling Brothers Circus comes through town, and in one of the most embarrassing moments in circus history, they discover Jake. Jake wanders into the sideshow, and he's a foot taller than the professional giant.
Let's talk about his style and achievements, as well as a painter, a sculptor, photographer, and even a poet.
So Jake's traveling with a circus, and the circus spent a lot of times in those days at Madison Square Garden. They spend a month there when they open their season. And Jake is there, and he's wandering through the basement of the old Madison Square Garden where they kept the menagerie, the animals, and the sideshow. And he sees a young woman sculpting one of the circus animals, and he stops, and you can imagine she's taken aback by someone of his size, and he asks her what she's doing. He says, "Can I try?" And he picks up a piece of unused clay, and in a few moments, and she's watching him, you know, and she's amazed by the size of his hands and his fingers. Each hand spans two octaves on a piano. Each finger is as big as a silver dollar, so you can imagine her amazement. But then when he finishes, she's more amazed by what he's created, this unbelievable likeness of a giraffe. So she is a very wealthy socialite, and she is friends with one of the Ringling brothers, and they, as a result of what she saw, they arranged for Jake to have a scholarship to art school. From that, he goes to art school, doesn't like it, finds it really confining. They're teaching representational art, meaning, you know, like it's photographic. You paint what you see. But he wants to be a modern artist. So he leaves, and he begins painting on his own. He finds modern teachers. He says, "I don't want to be one of those purple mountain painters. With bold strokes and bright colors, I want to embrace the world of modern art." So he starts to paint. He continues to sculpt, award-winning photographer and a poet.
Dr. Andrew Ehrlich is the author of The Long Shadows, the story of Jake Ehrlich, the silent film and circus giant who was his uncle. It's available at Amazon.com and thelongshadowsbook.com.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only On Air is online at iTunes, YouTube, and FeedBurner.com. But to continue, we really need your tax-deductible donation. Please pledge to DavidEarsOnly at gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Justin Ewan at Hanger Studio Play It Productions. With interns Rachel Murray and Kaimana Larson, I'm Catherine Herzog.
Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts with support from the Gatewave.org Radio Reading Service for Those with Disabilities, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, and award-winning ACAM Associates, Exceptional Management, Impeccable Reputation for New York Co-ops, Condos, and Condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. I'm David Alpern.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Kaimana Larson. This week last year, we looked at what Rupert Murdoch called the most humiliating day of my life, testifying in a parliamentary investigation of phone hacking in Great Britain, maybe beyond, also payments to police, other alleged illegalities and improprieties by his News Corp media empire. For my July 24th, 2011 broadcast, hosted by Catherine and David.
These actions do not live up to the standards that our company aspires to everywhere around the world, and it is our determination to both put things right, make sure these things don't happen again, and to be the company that I know we have always aspired to be. As for my comments, the closure of the News of the World newspaper.
I would just like to say one sentence. This is the most humble day of my life.
Media baron Rupert Murdoch at a parliamentary hearing last week claimed long ignorance of widespread wrongdoing by reporters and editors at the News of the World, the best-selling British tabloid he subsequently closed because of reported phone hacking and police payoffs. But he couldn't control his famed hands-on style when he interrupted his own son and heir apparent, James Murdoch, to get in an early bite of televised humble pie.
A shaving cream pie came later in the hearings, but the real damage was to the credibility of father and son. James admitted authorizing major payment to a News of the World hacking victim in 2009, but said he thought only one rogue reporter was involved. Afterwards, a former company editor and lawyer announced they had shown him evidence the problem was more far-reaching. Parliament wants to know more. Meanwhile, top Scotland Yard and United Kingdom police officials resigned over reports of payoffs and foot-dragging on investigations of Murdoch Company wrongdoing.
Across the pond, as they say, the FBI and Congress were considering reports that the Murdochs' minions had violated U.S. law. More important, there were questions on Wall Street about the penalty being paid by their News Corporation stock because of the British improprieties, also because of Murdoch's money-losing loyalty to the newspaper business, where he first made his mark, and his mistakes in the new digital world. News Corp recently unloaded MySpace for a mere $35 million after buying it 6 years ago for more than half a billion. To talk more about the company's financial and ethical cloud, for your ears only, we're joined again by Dan Gross, economics editor and columnist for Yahoo Finance. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Even before the current scandal, you wrote last week there was a Murdoch discount on News Corp stock. What does that mean and how do you calculate it?
Well, you know, analysts could go through and say, you know, he owns this satellite system in the UK, he's got the Fox network, all the assets, and if you were to ascribe a value to each of them, it would add up to $70 or $80 billion in a healthy market, and yet News Corp stock was only trading for about $40 or $45 billion. And one of the reasons is that the Murdoch family controls that company through a special class of shares that give them voting rights, so he runs it like his own personal fiefdom. And, you know, you are either buying or selling Rupert Murdoch, and for many years, buying Rupert Murdoch was a great idea. He created entirely new businesses. He created the Fox Network, Fox News Channel, pioneered satellite TV in much of Europe, making a lot of money for everybody. But in recent years, his judgment has clearly been clouded. He's been setting money on fire with his purchase of MySpace. He had to pay a gigantic premium for the Wall Street Journal. They've now written down half the value of that purchase. He bought a production company run by his daughter called Shine for several $100 million. And because of the company's general bad reputation and failure to sort of ride herd on News of the World and those sorts of things, it recently had to withdraw from buying the rest of BSkyB, which is a big UK satellite TV company that it owns most of. It wanted to buy the rest of it. And the regulator said, you know what, you can't. So all those sorts of things are, you know, destroying shareholder value, and the board and shareholders are really powerless to do anything.
And now you see what you call a Murdoch premium on what News Corp operations must pay to attract and hold top talent.
Exactly. You know, if you, and I see this especially with the Wall Street Journal. You know, the dirty little secret was that the Journal and the New York Times never paid at the top of the market for New York media jobs. Part of the reason you worked there was for, you know, good working conditions, good colleagues, but a lot of it was because of the prestige. It was easier to get your phone calls returned when you made a, you know, got a story, it had more of an impact. We now live in a world in which the Bloombergs and Reuters and Yahoos and AOLs of the world are willing to pay more to attract talent. And the reality is that the Journal doesn't want to compete on, you know, price for, and it never had to because it was the Journal. Now, if the credibility of the overall company is suffering, all of a sudden you have to pay more to get the same person. And that's exactly what is the case at Fox News Channel and Fox Business Network, because those places don't have big audience. Well, in the case of Fox Business, it doesn't have a big audience. In the case of Fox News, it has a very poor reputation in its industry. They have to pay people more to go work there. And that's sort of the Murdoch premium.
The News Corp stock price rose after the Murdoch's see no evil parliamentary testimony, but also after published speculation Murdoch Sr. might give up control and take a sort of figurehead title. Which do you see as the real trigger?
You know, I think a couple things. One, maybe a sense that the worst was over after those hearings, although there is new stuff coming out suggesting that James Murdoch, Rupert's son, knew more than he gave off. And a second was Rupert Murdoch's performance. You know, he said it was the most humble day of his life. I would say it was the most mumble day of his life. He was revealed to be this really old sort of doddering guy who was not with it. He was nodding off at one point. And you sort of think, this is the guy everybody has been so scared of all these years. But it also was obvious from that performance that even though he is, you know, in charge, that his role at the top is not really tenable for all that much longer. He doesn't seem to have the vigor or the insight or the vision or the ability to, you know, run all these different operations the way he used to. So on the one hand, there is a sense that, you know, I think part of the reason the stock went up is this notion that they may be turning a page on Murdoch's running of the company. And also, you know, to the degree this makes it less likely
that James Murdoch takes over, I think that's a positive for the stock. Picking CEOs based on genetics, based on the fact that they are related to the prior CEO, is a really bad way of doing it, as shareholders of the New York Times and the Washington Post Company have learned.
There are also reports Murdoch could sidestep some of his stock problems by spinning off News Corp's more profitable media arms, TV, satellite, movie studios, and isolating the newspapers that do more to boast his ego and political influence than shareholder returns. What's your view on that?
I guess that's always a possibility, but, you know, Rupert Murdoch is a newspaper man. He talked emotionally in that hearing about his father, who kind of came from nothing, who had a little newspaper that he basically gave to him. He talked about, you know, he is wedded to the New York Post, which loses money year after year. The thing he most wanted in life, you know, what seemed to be his rosebud, was the Wall Street Journal. His devotion to the News of the World and competing in the way it did is what led to these problems. He's still a guy with ink stains, so it's entirely possible he might spin them off into some entity, but he seems very much to be wedded to them in a way that other executives at the company probably are not.
Dan Gross is economics editor and columnist at Yahoo Finance.
More Murdoch mess from our July 24th, 2011 broadcast. By last week, police had arrested 24 people in connection with the News Corporation phone hacking scandal and another 41 linked to suspected payoffs to officials. Hard as it was for Murdoch, he recently agreed to split his beloved newspapers from the more profitable TV, movie, and entertainment elements of his empire. Last week, too, major News Corp shareholders renewed a campaign to have Murdoch resign as chairman. A committee of Britain's parliament earlier had said the Australian-born media mogul was, quote, not a fit person, unquote, to run an international business. I'm Kaimana Larson. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, Karen Oberlin again, echoing the testimony of many atop the Murdoch media empire.
I don't care if there's powder on my nose. I don't care if my hairdo is in place. I've lost the very meaning of repose. I never put a mud pack on my face. Oh, who'd have thought that I'd walk in a daze now? I never go to shows at night, just to matinees now. I see the show and home I go. Once I laughed when I heard you sing that I'd be playing solitaire. Uneasy in my easy chair. It never entered my mind. Once you told me that I was mistaken, that I'd awaken with the sun. An order, orange juice for one. It never entered my mind. What I lack myself, and now I even have to scratch my back myself. Once you warned me that if you scorn me, I'd sing the maiden's prayer again. that you were there again. To get into my hair again. It never entered my mind.